All right, if you guys could take your seats or take your conversations outside, we're going to start a panel. Right now we have the future and the current innovations of crowdfunding and lending going on. I'll let Kenneth take it away.
Enjoy. All right. I'm Kevin Lawton. I guess I get to do this panel or moderate it because I wrote a book on crowdfunding called The Crowdfunding Revolution. And now while I'm sort of a talking head here, I want to tell you that these guys are the real deal. These are the people that are changing the way that we're financing things. They're doing real companies, and if you look in the past, you'll find out that they've done real good companies before. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give just a real quick micro pitch about who these people are and what they do, and then I'm just want to go dig straight into some Q&A and some conversations with these panelists, and let's get to the bottom of crowdfunding. So really quickly, right to my left here is Paul Blythe. He's the CFO of MicroPlace. And MicroPlace, I guess I would pitch as if Kiva was for profit and they securitized their loans, then you'd have something like MicroPlace. I hope that's fairly accurate. we've got Chris Larson. He's the CEO and co-founder of Prosper. If you haven't heard of Prosper, maybe you've heard of something like Lending Club or Zopa in the UK. So they do peer-to-peer. I guess Prosper is one of the two bigger peer-to-peer lending companies in the U.S. and in the world, I believe, too. And then to his left is Danae Ringelman, and she's the COO of Indiegogo, co-founder. I'll let you get, they can give you a little bit of background on themselves. I decided that if they want to do that, it'd be better than me talking about their past. But they've all been at some pretty interesting companies in the past, and if not even in the space before. So we also have one more panelist who's going to come in maybe in a few minutes, Jessica Jackley. And she's the CEO of ProFounder, and she was from Kiva before. And I expect her maybe any minute now. So let me get right into it, because I think you want to hear about crowdfunding and you want to understand it as much as you want to find out who we are. So the thing about crowdfunding is that it seems to have a very coincidental time frame compared to sort of the demise of the other forms of financing in the world. You've seen the kind of crash in the credit markets and Wall Street and all that since like 2008. And, right about that same time, crowdfunding's, really entered the public zeitgeist. It's kind of going exponential now. And so one of the first things I want to find out from the panelists is the sort of demise of the other forms of financing, is that the rationale for crowdfunding? Is that why it is here? Would crowdfunding have occurred anyway? And, or is it largely driven by sort of the problems that we have in the other forms of finance. So maybe we'll just go right down the panel here and start with Paul.
Thank you for the introduction. I wouldn't say it's happened because of the problem that we've had both in the developed world and the developing world, but I would say that perhaps its success may well be driven by the financial crisis. So in the United States, 75% of net new jobs are created by small businesses, but banks are sitting on huge amounts of cash. They're just awash with liquidity, but they're not lending. And in fact, if you follow the Small Business Association statistics, the interest rates are increasing for small business and the lending standards are getting tighter. So what does this mean? We've got a lot of unemployed people, a lot of people who want to start businesses, but there's not a lot of funding. So if you look at the pure economics of it, there's a huge opportunity there to be able to invest and lend and create value, which is not being satisfied by traditional modalities. And therefore, I think the success of crowdfunding may well be exacerbated or improved through the current situation.
So maybe then if the banks are sitting on these big cash piles, maybe Chris, would you like to speak about, is there a way that we can allow these banks to maybe participate in crowdfunding and kind of unleash some of that cash pile?
I think so. I mean, these are really kind of built as infrastructures or platforms where anybody can deploy money on the systems. But I think to the earlier point, You know, I don't think this is a result of traditional sources really drying up. This whole movement, I think, is kind of a third kind of phase of finance online. So the first phase was sort of informational, you know, Yahoo Finance, I'm just going to get financial information online. Second phase was sort of traditional ways of financing things moving online, so doing transactions online. So E-Trade, you know, would be a good example of that. I think this is kind of now kind of recognizing that the web can do things that you couldn't do before. So now it's transacting in kind of a new model. So while I think the traditional guys could participate, I think this will either become a kind of a whole new business model or not, based on, you know, kind of reordering how things get financed. So whether you have you know, a tight credit market like we've had over the last 2 years, or you have a very loose credit market like you had the first 2 years that P2P started. We started back in 06. That was a pretty rip-roaring credit environment. And actually, you're coming back into, things are loosening up for sure. And you saw New York Times this morning, you know, auto lending is definitely back. You know, regular securitization is coming back. We're definitely going into a boom. Credit's going to get really loose again. But I think crowdfunding sort of has a place even in that environment, because fundamentally this should be a more efficient model of, you know, owners of money can deploy that money, no matter who they are, and take the spread and take the risk, because before they were pretty much banned by the government from doing that. And then that should flow through the lower cost of credit than the traditional guys, I think, can deploy. So I think they could participate, but I think ultimately, you know, if this really succeeds, it's going to be because you've reordered the model around, you know, kind of social, the ability for anybody to trade their money. And that's just a fundamentally different market.
Mm-hmm. So, Danae, I think Indiegogo, and if people don't know or use Indiegogo, it's, to me, it's sort of like Kickstarter, but it has a little bit of a more creative bias. Would that be accurate?
Actually, we're broader with creative, entrepreneurial, and cause focus.
Okay. And it seems like that space, I guess, like you might call it the kind of perks-based crowdfunding, mm-hmm. That's substantially different than the rest of the kind of financial realm. And so maybe it's sort of unique in that probably would have happened in any case, right?
Yeah, I mean, when your question about is this a new trend, yeah. We probably have a little bit broader definition of what crowdfunding is, and that to us just means the pooling of capital together to get something off the ground. And that has existed since the beginning of time. So there's no trend here. What's just different is kind of alluding to what Chris just said, is the tools are getting better to make that the transacting and pooling of the funds more efficient with the web, and now with Indiegogo, we're really leveraging social media. And we know for a fact that actually only less than 20% of funds that move into businesses to start ventures in the country come from venture capital and angel. Most of the, over 80% of the funds come from people's personal savings, credit cards, refinancing their mortgages. There's a huge opportunity to make the facilitation of capital more efficient. So that's what that's what we do, is we just allow people to contribute to projects, to businesses in exchange for perks. So you can pre-buy a product, or you can you know, get absolutely nothing except a thank you.
Right. Now, with Indiegogo, obviously, it's kind of the farthest in terms of crowdfunding from securities and maybe the SEC purview and all that. But maybe that's a good segue into the next point that I had, which is, you know, the first reaction I hear from a lot of people about crowdfunding is, oh, my God, is that legal? You know, aren't you stepping on the SEC and all these kind of regulations? And maybe we can just go down the panel here and get your thoughts about the SEC boogeyman. I know with Prosper and your buddies at Lending Club, and you've had your own kind of run-ins with the SEC and whatnot, kind of shook out that situation. So you've probably got some pretty interesting things to say. But I'd like to hear a little bit just from each of the panelists about regulation and you know, where do you stand on that? What's the big thing preventing from what you really want to do in crowdfunding? And what are you able to do?
Do you want to start with Chris?
Sure, why not? Let's start with Chris.
You know, we started in 06, and for the first 2 years, there really wasn't a clear sort of roadmap on who was even going to regulate, you know, peer-to-peer lending. even though we had approached the SEC about a year before that. But it was about 08 that the SEC decided they wanted to grab the industry and sort of pull it into the securities world, which we thought was always a mistake. We thought these, you know, our industry should be regulated more like a new type of bank. But, you know, so that happened. There's nothing you can do about it. The lesson learned is, you know, you cannot fight the SEC. You just can't. They will win. So they have unlimited power, unlimited resources. And they're basically, there's very few checks and balances on the SEC. So they're judge, jury, and executioner. So you need to be very careful. My recommendation is, you know, stay away from any model that involves them. Once you get into that world, it's going to change what you want to do. But so it took us about 9 months, probably $10 million to get through the SEC. There should be 10 P2P lending companies in America. There's only two that were well-funded enough to survive what had to happen. And that's really a shame, particularly when you see what's going on in China. But I'd say kind of there's a split going on now. There are the things that Indiegogo can do. If you look at the site, it's kind of like peer-to-peer was back in 06, 07. It's kind of rich with kind of personal content. It's really engaging. You've got, you know, so many choices of what you want to do, what you can say. It's the true sort of social experience that, you know, we're hoping the world kind of moves into. And then you have the folks that are regulated by SEC or sort of the traditional regulators. And that is becoming more and more like still a new channel of financing, but it's being... The problem is the regulators aren't looking at this all through the eyes of what can be done with technology, what Silicon Valley is pumping out right now, all the great things happening in social media and kind of global interaction. They're looking at it under the lens of the old traditional channel, like E-Trade. They're 10 years behind what's going on, and no one is making a merit judgment about where this can go and what it can do for our country. So what happens? Still to this day, small businesses cannot use peer-to-peer lending platforms. They can't.
So that brings up an interesting question. So, you know, these two companies have made it through this gauntlet with the SEC because they're well-funded and had enough time to do it. Is that the kind of effort that's scalable in the sense that other P2P companies could come along and use that work, or do they have to run through the same gauntlet themselves?
No, it's an incredible barrier to entry. I mean, frankly, in some ways, we got through it and, you know, things are going really well and, you know, we spent a ton of money. And in some ways, frankly, we look selfishly and say, that's a great barrier to entry. Cool. Yeah. Thanks, SEC, for protecting us, because that's what's happening. It's stopping, you know, a million great ideas out there being developed at colleges or people coming out of Facebook, people coming out of Google that look at finance and go, man, this industry is so colossally screwed up. And now we've got all this great technology and there's so much fat spread being taken by, you know, Chase and, you know, you name it. The credit spreads are insanely rich right now. Yet all of you are not allowed to use your money to your full advantage. That is because of this ultimate corruption between sort of the New York Wall Street and DC, who look at all of you folks out here on the West Coast with disdain. So as long as you are doing things that are like entertainment, dating, or frankly,
Facebook.
Finance that doesn't allow you to make money, because that's what like Kickstarter and Indiegogo, I hope you guys are able to move over. But again, that's the split that's going on. As long as you're not allowing people to make money, as long as it's sort of on the fringes and not stepping on Wall Street's toes, you can do it. The minute you get into our territory, it's a different story. So, I mean, there needs to be a revolution of people protesting in front of these regulators in Washington to wake up on what the opportunity is here. Nothing about our company, but this is about what Silicon Valley could be the new Wall Street in 10 years. But the way it's going, no way in hell that's going to happen.
We do there have is. Facebook and digital currency, and we can kind of do fake farming and stuff like that.
The Facebook credit thing is super interesting. I mean, that whole currency thing is fascinating.
There is actually a petition in SEC right in DC right now to change crowdfunding law, and it the writing of it actually was crowdfunded on Indiegogo. So people contributed money to get their name onto this petition to change crowdfunding law. So it's a little bit meta, if you can think about it that. But if you go, you can actually sign it. You know, there is definitely, they're open to it. The SEC is open to it. They're just not sure if there's enough demand. And so what we're saying here in terms of demand is what's happened because of the 1933, 1934 securities laws, which were written to protect people from, you know, losing their entire net worth on speculative investments, and they weren't educated enough to know that they were about to lose their entire net worth. those laws were enacted, and as a result, people who want to invest $100 into their cousin's restaurant or $1,000 into their friend's iPhone app company can't. So that's the kind of level that we're talking about. We're not talking about angel investment for high net worth individuals. We're talking about Joe Schmo people, you know, average people who just want to put their money to work and make a little return. But because of the laws, they can't. However, the intention and the reasons people want to make these investments, I think, run the gamut. And so when we talk about investing, we talk about a spectrum from pure ROI, which is, I think, what you guys are trying to enable, which is amazing, to just pure donation, if you want to think about it. Indiegogo, we sit in between in along that spectrum. But a lot of people who want to invest $100 or $1,000 into their cousin's restaurant, they want to make a return, but they also want to see that guy succeed, and you want to see that restaurant go live. And if they make $1,000 back, great. If not, you know, it was a good $1,000 well spent because they got an experience out of it. So that's the user demand that exists across the country, across the world. And that's the area that I think the SEC, if they kind of tap into a little bit better, can open up by changing some laws. And you can actually go on and vote in the petition and get involved if you want to go to DC.
I've seen things on Indiegogo like bakeries and microbreweries, yeah. Right? What's the biggest business-like thing that's been started on Indiegogo?
Well, there's all kinds of uses for that we've seen on Indiegogo, from bakeries like you talked about, who had taken out a loan to start their business, and instead of going out and taking a second $15,000 loan, they went on to Indiegogo. They pre-sold baked goods as a way to raise money for their expansion capital. We just had a company raise $25,000. They just needed some seed capital. They got rejected by 43 venture capitalists who said, go get into the market and validate that you have a market, and then come talk to us. And they're like, that's why we're talking to you, is because we have this hardware product that takes capital to get into the market. So they went on Indiegogo and they raised $25,000 by pre-selling the product to just manufacture about 100 or so prototypes. And now the VCs are calling on their door. So interesting change of dynamic, because they're showing that there's market demand for their product. So it changes the game entirely.
And it's largely customers actually funding you in that sense, right?
It's customer financing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So with Paul, you have securitized loans, right? So you're quite different in that sense from Kiva. So
can you explain that
and talk about regulation.
Well, in terms of just to respond to your regulation question, I'll answer your question as well. I kind of see, similar to what our other panelists have said, but I sort of, there's three ways forward. You can join Chris and I on the bleeding edge and try to make change in a regulated environment. It is about 100 times more difficult than I ever anticipated, and I am a very boring, risk-averse bean counter by training. So this was not rose-tinted spectacles going into this. Incredibly difficult, and all sorts of things against you. That's one way forward. The other way forward is to get work in the kind of legal space, such as Indiegogo. So I take an e-commerce route. So it's not investment per se. It's kind of more e-commerce, i.e., you pre-purchase or goods and so on. And so you get around it being a security. Well, there's possibly a third way, which I'm not innovative or clever enough to do, which is more along the lines of virtual currency. So if it just gets too difficult to use the current currencies that we have, and you can create a virtual currency, then you can avoid everything. Although this sounds bizarre and daft, it's actually not that bizarre and daft, because all a currency is something that's liquid that I can trade with you. So if you value it and I value it and we agree that value, then it becomes useful as currency. And the sort of anecdote I have on this, which I think is really quite fascinating if you're into economics and currencies and you're a bit of a digital currency nerd, and I'm kind of getting that way. You may well have heard of the M-Pesa system, Safaricom in Kenya. Anyone heard of that? Yeah? Okay. Essentially, using mobile currency to transact for all sorts of goods and services and
remit money intra-country. So effectively using your mobile phone to buy and sell things, using Kenyan shillings, the currency of Kenya. Okay. Radical, fantastic, working, brilliant, significantly improving the economy of Kenya. All good. What's weird is that in Uganda, people are using M-Pesa Kenyan shillings to transact for goods and services. Now, if you're into this stuff, that is very radical. Someone in Ugandan village is buying goods and services from somebody else, either in the same village or someone they don't even know a long way away, and they're transacting using Kenyan shillings. And I don't know, I'll BS you, but I would bet 20 grand that they're not calling into the London Futures Exchange to find out what the value of the Kenyan shillings is over the next few days. Right? What they're doing is they're meeting someone in a marketplace going, you know what, I think it's worth about 100. Okay, we're good for that. And I know, and I'm willing to take that if I'm selling the good to buy something else because I know someone else has a value for it. So the idea of a virtual currency is not that weird. And that would really scare government. Like, talk about scaring the SEC and revolution. Take away the government's ability to control currency. That is radical.
Now you piss off the Federal Reserve, too.
But if you think about the economics of it, how much does a nickel cost to make? Anybody know?
A little over 5 cents.
More than a nickel. Think about the taxation implications. Who uses cash primarily? Criminals.
Now, don't you all feel good about yourself?
So they can avoid tax, right?
So Paul, I should mention to people that, so Paul's from Microplace, and Microplace is owned by eBay since maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I think. Mm-hmm. Is this maybe a sign of what's to come from PayPal and
yeah,
friends?
Yeah, no, I think you better talk to Scott about that. I think I might get in trouble if I talk about virtual currencies, because what's interesting, if you get into the sort of virtual currency, digital currency kind of nerddom, chatting, blogging world, you'll see there's a big, PayPal's future, I actually effectively work for PayPal, though I'm a subsidiary of eBay legally. I work with that business is fantastic, absolutely fantastic, and growing. Billio, what a great platform, what a great opportunity. But if you look in the digital currency kind of blogosphere, if a virtual currency comes about, then that's a challenge to actually the PayPal business model. So, yeah. I don't think PayPal has any plans to launch virtual currency that I'm aware of.
I figured I'd give you a chance to just kind of put that out there. So this actually vectors into the next point I had, which is, we're talking about, especially with the peer-to-peer currency and all these kinds of things. I mean, this is crowdfunding, is this investment anarchy here? We're talking about letting the general public and the world at large really do investments that people in suits running around, doing meetings and stuff used to do. Let's talk about this whole new model, in terms of, is there going to be groupthink problems? What's the performance going to be? What are the returns?
Well, the groupthink problem is what we've got now. So, I guess I could, why don't I take the mickey out of myself? Why should 40 or 50-year-old bald blokes in suits make decisions about investment, particularly if they've all been to the same university or similar universities, and they hire people who've gone to the same universities? Oh, gosh, oh, yes, of course, you went to Cambridge. Of course, I'll give you a job. I mean, really, I would much rather trust the wisdom of the crowd. Much more. I mean, this group of individuals out there are much more likely to come up with a good decision than this group of individuals here, even if you've never heard of crowdfunding before you walked into this room. And that is a really basic, for example, private equity investor is really frustrated with the fact that he has to rely on a bunch of Stanford grads to make his decisions for him. He would far rather reach out to the crowd. In terms of investment anarchy, I just think that's patronizing.
Chris, what do you think about that?
I think the wisdom of the crowd thing is naive. I mean, we started out that way. Certainly when we started the company in 2005, it was the height of Web 2.0, sort of libertarian, markets ruled. The key thing then was don't be the friendster police, so don't get in the way. So our model originally was anybody can list a loan and anybody can invest in that and they can set the price. It's up to them to determine. And that was really empowering and engaging. But in those years when we allowed that, we had about a net 5% negative ROI. People were, you had irrational exuberance, I think, of people bidding below what the default rate would be on a loan, for example. So I think that was too much freedom. And as we've evolved the model, you know, we've increasingly moved to putting guardrails in place. So don't let people bid below, you know, the risk-free rate plus the default rate. We kind of moved to there. And now we've moved actually completely to a fixed price. So where we kind of experts in our company, risk experts, are actually setting the price for a particular loan that comes in. And I think in some ways, you know, kind of that's enough for right now. Then people are still able to choose, okay, I want to back that person. I want to back that person who's doing that small business. And here's the rate and here's the return. And that's working out really well. So now we're clocking at about 10.5% ROIs. That's after defaults and after costs. So that's great. So that's really, we think, the way it should be now. I think slowly then you'll start trying to pick up more of the social interaction. So still that idea that a friend of yours who bids on that loan, you know, our data shows that drives about a 20 to 40% improvement in risk. I think as we see more and more of that, that's where you're gonna see the power of the wisdom of the crowd. But you have to have a baseline set by experts to make it safe enough. The other thing is, you know, these vintages take a long time. So whether it be an equity, you know, if you're funding a very small business through equity, or it be through a loan, it's about 2 to 4 years before you find out how it went. So that's a long time to let the crowd run wild and then kind of figure out two or three, 4 years later. The truth is, the public isn't that patient, and they'll take you out to the woodshed. And then probably the regulators will come in and clamp down on you. So I think it's, you have to control it when you start, and then slowly try to test where you can loosen up. I think that's the way it will go now.
Danae, you look like you had a comment there.
Yeah. I mean, in addition to the question of is the crowd better at making the investment bet or a couple individuals, and say we say that the crowd is better, even that put aside, there's even other benefits to crowdfunding than just a new source of capital or a complementary source of capital. And that's the fact that you now have a crowd emotionally invested in your company who is talking about you and tweeting about you now in this world of social media. So the marketing benefit to having the crowd finance your idea is incredible. The market validation that happens when people put their money and vote with their dollar, as well as the participation that's unleashed. We've had campaigns that they put their funding kind of call out into the world, and the amount of serendipity that comes back to them with people buying them URLs on their behalf because they'll know that they'll need, you know, those URLs purchased one day. You know, think the benefit of just having a swell of a community around your investment and your endeavor can bring so much more than just money.
So
it has.
That kind of capital never existed before in investing, right? I mean, it was really hard to access that.
It was inefficient. I mean, people were always doing it. Like, they were borrowing from their friends. They were keeping spreadsheets. They were, you know, promising that they were going to spend the money and, you know, send people emails or pick up the phone and call. But now with the internet and with technology and reporting so streamlined and the way efficient communication channels, it's very easy to raise money from your friends, friends of friends, and people who are your future customers who want your product in the market.
So we've talked about the old guard investing, and then we've talked about tapping the general crowd as investment. So maybe the third thing, the third kind of class of investments or ways to invest is something that's kind of close to my heart, and that is letting machines do the work. So there have been a few quant VCs that have been started recently. For example, InLabs Ventures uses a quantitative approach to deciding which startup should be invested. And there's another company called Right Side Capital Management, which I kind of labeled dartboard capital. So they have figured that if you look at the angel data, you can actually just pick startups, and with a large enough portfolio size or enough darts, basically throwing at the dartboard, you can get a pretty good return. And there are ways to enhance that on top of that, like prediction markets and stuff, et cetera. I'd like to get people's opinions on, you know, could we let algorithms actually make decisions using their crowdfunding platforms, and what would those returns look like? What do they see in the future in terms of algorithms?
Do you want me to go first?
Yeah, why not?
Not really my expertise. I'll keep it brief. computers versus people. Well, I guess a lot of people would say you're better off picking an index than you are picking a fund manager. I think there's a lot of stats around that. Mm. But interestingly, without fund managers, they kind of have to go hand in hand. You can't have it all done by machines. So I think probably that's my direct answer to your question in terms of specifically at MicroPlace. It's not people buy MicroPlace to invest in microfinance around the world and here in the United States, and they do it for all sorts of reasons. So I think you're primarily talking about return on investment.
Yeah, return-based investment.
So a lot of people come to our website because they want to support the Kenyan Women's Finance Trust in Kenya because they're motivated by Kenya and what the work started up by ex-teachers and so on. That's what they want to do. And they're looking for a dual return. They're not just looking for a financial return. So it doesn't really apply to what we do.
But so Chris, can we quantify Prosper?
Yeah, I mean, that's effectively how we set our risk ratings, you know, today. They're sort of a living, breathing, you know, amalgamation of all the data of a particular, you know, kind of slice or tranche of loans. And that could be something that is, you know, determined by the minute, and it could be something that's determined by, you know, number of people that friended you before they made a bid, for example, whether that be for equity or for debt. So, yeah, I don't think you're that far off. You probably still want risk experts to sort of look at it before it goes live to make sure something weird isn't happening.
Some human vetting and a little bit of hybrid, but
yeah, but
quants could do a job. Yeah. So I'll ask maybe one more, or we'll talk about one more point, and then we'll do the Q&A section. One of the things that I find interesting is that, especially with some crowdfunding sites that have kind of a strong branding and a philosophy and are really trying to do good with the world, you know, what would happen if someone wanted to fund a project that was like legally okay, maybe borderline okay, but sort of morally, you know, offensive, or you know, it didn't suit your branding? You know, would you reject those kind of projects from funding in your sites?
Yeah, MicroPlace definitely. So when we do our due diligence on any of the issuers that we offer, we do credit analysis, type due diligence that people are probably most familiar with, but we also do one associated with brand and ethics. So yeah, absolutely, no question, we would reject them. But that's I'm speaking for MicroPlace.
Right. How about Chris?
I mean, it's a tricky question. Generally, Web 2.0 has definitely moved into the direction of censorship. You know, even on Facebook. You know, Facebook started. They say like we don't censor. Well, of course they do. You know, see nudity on even on other people's networks, really. So obviously YouTube censors. So I think any successful brand has to protect the brand. So we certainly pull down things that are inappropriate. But I think you try to. You have to stay pure to the whole idea here, which is still these are infrastructures and people should be able to do what they want to do. But I think you're always going to have a struggle within these companies to figure out where the line is.
So Jessica, you walked in just at the right time to answer a fantastic question.
Oh, great.
Which is, if someone came to you to fund a project that was, it was legal, but let's say it was morally offensive or didn't suit your brand name, would you fund it?
Well, so if I may give the quick one sentence sort of overview of what ProFounder does.
Why not?
So yeah. ProFounder doesn't fund things. So yeah. It's a tool for people to use their community and do sort of a community-based crowdfunding to get it done. So I think I would guess that, and this would be my personal opinion, that we would be pretty agnostic as to the project. We just want to provide tools for people to do what they want to do in the world.
You don't do any brand screening or anything like that?
I mean, the brand is, can we provide tools that allow people to get done in the world what they want to get done in the world? So if we could do that, I would feel good about it. I mean, there might be conversations that we would have offline about it with the user, but we haven't encountered it thus far. Right. There have been ones, if I can quickly swap hats and not speak as kind of the voice of Kiva, but with Kiva, we had a lot of interesting things come up where there have been entrepreneurs doing things that in other cultures are perfectly acceptable. There was a really interesting posting one time for somebody raising money to do cockfighting. And so there have been things that have come up in the past on Kiva for sure where conversations had to be had about like what is acceptable and what wasn't. Can I just say, I'm so sorry that I'm late. Burbank, there's ice on the plane's wings this morning. And they don't know how to deal with ice in Southern California, so they let it sit in the sunshine. It's still the greatest airport ever, but that's what I was sitting with the plane, like basking in the sun for 2 hours. So sorry.
Okay, one more quick point, and then we'll do the Q&A. And that I really wanted to bring this out.
Can I answer real quick on that same? Yeah. So, I mean, we kind of actually take an eBay approach, which is we have a terms of use that's very explicit and can remove anything, but we rely on the community to kind of flag stuff. Plus the fact that it's the community funding these ideas, so if it's kind of a weird project and nobody wants it to succeed, it won't succeed. Yeah. So it's just the dynamics of crowdfunding, which helps keep the riffraff unsuccessful.
Use the crowd. I like it. So the one point I wanted to talk about before the Q&A was this whole idea about gender parity and investment. And thanks to Danae for some data here, actually, a while ago when I did a Huffington Post article on this. But so it turns out about only 8% of VC-backed startup companies are actually women-led. But if you look in either the small business world or the successful campaigns on Indiegogo, they're about 41-42% that are women-led. So maybe we'll go down to the end of the table here and the girl power side, talk about what's going on there.
Yeah, actually, I didn't do the analysis until Kevin asked me to actually look at who's succeeding on Indiegogo from a gender perspective. And I just think it gets back to when you give everybody the equal tools to succeed and you don't make them rely on maybe the relationships, the one-off relationships that they happen to have to connect to money, then a lot more success actually happens. So on Indiegogo, 41% of all successful campaigns are run by women. I think a lot of that too is we service the entrepreneurial community, so there's small businesses raising money, as well as the creative community, so musicians and artists of any kind, as well as causes and charities, so people who want to raise money for cancer research can also raise. So which I think because of that, it's a broader spectrum of the world, and men and women are equally involved in all of those things. So I think that might be an element as well. But it just gets back to if you give people the tools to get the word out about their endeavor, their business, and they do a good job executing on that, then they can actually raise the money and get the idea off the ground.
Awesome. Jessica?
I agree with everything that you said. Would also say that with ProFounder, one thing that was, I think, one of the most aha moments for us in the last year and a half researching to start this was that while VC is very important, it obviously is only a very small slice of the pie. And so
only your VCs are important, right?
What's that?
Your VCs are important.
Oh, ours. Yes, we have a wonderful community. but we... We actually crowdfunded for ProFounder's first two rounds of funding, so we have friends and family as well as professional investors involved, which is pretty nice. So what was I going to say here? It turns out that 87%+ of funding for private companies in the U.S. does not come from VC, but comes from friends and family. And so I think as we provide more tools for people to do that in a way that is, it's actual investing, right, where there's a dynamic share of the financial upside, as we provide those tools and that confidence for people, I think we'll see more people, more women, stepping up to do that and get funded in non-traditional ways, perhaps, or actually traditional ways, but they're not intuitive, not what we think of when we think of professional real funding. And I also think it'll provide more opportunities just for women to see that this is a path. I mean, we can get into the whole debate, probably don't want to, about are there women entrepreneurs out there or not, and there are, and why aren't they funded or underfunded? Why aren't they showing up in the offices of VCs? But that's probably a different conversation. Right. I'm just excited for this tool to allow more people to see this path, to get involved as investors as well as entrepreneurs.
Okay. Now, Chris, aren't you an investor in ProFounder?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So along with
I was trying to do, that's what threw me out. I was like, should I
along
say
with the crowdfunding, yes. He's an investor too.
Well, and just as a note, 7 million ventures get started just in the United States every year, and that's more than the number of babies born in the United States. It's a different kind of baby. Yeah. And to Justin's point, I was shocked when I learned these numbers. The average amount of capital needed for these 7 million ventures, so this includes everything from us, like venture back to, you know, food carts, is $48,000. And the median amount required, so 3.5 million ventures, actually need less than $4,300 to start. That's the opportunity that Jessica and, you know, we're all talking about here is 87%. Yeah, I had read over 80% of money comes from friends, family, credit cards, personal loans, the non-traditional sources of funding, not SBA, not VCs, not angels, not to say that those are bad. It's just a much smaller pool of capital.
That alone is reason enough to have crowdfunding, if you ask me. What? Just that opportunity alone is enough reason to have crowdfunding. So that's actually a great time to move into the Q&A section. And I'm not sure what the deal is with microphones out there. This gentleman here has a microphone. Let's have some really hard-hitting questions for the panelists. Big and meaty. Maybe this guy here?
Ted Nelson, Project Xanadu. I misunderstood, or may have misunderstood, Ms. Ringelman, when you said that there's no way a friend or a relative can invest in a small business. I thought that was always perfectly legitimate. I thought it was the public offering, which was the crossing line that the SEC took over.
Yeah, I should. Public, no way to do it online. So if you put your investment online, that's deemed a public offering. So if you wanted to, yes, you could email a couple friends, and then there's certain Reg D, which I know Jessica can probably talk in great detail about in terms of limiting the number of people you can show it to. But if you put anything online, the SEC calls that a public offering. If you do a public offering, you must register it with the SEC. That can cost upwards of $50,000, $100,000. If you're only trying to raise $20,000 to get your business off the ground, it's a moot point. Like, it's impossible.
Maybe this guy back here? Or actually, if you've got a question, let's have it there, since you're close. Yeah, go for it, man.
It seems like one of the important things for these types of platforms is having good information, not only for people who want to invest to make sure they're doing the right, making the right decisions, but also for people who are putting out an offering to make sure that they can take advantage of this type of financing in a sort of new environment. How do each of you ensure that both sides of the spectrum have the information they need to make the right choices?
So it's a question about disclosures and
in terms of Microplace, it's very structured and very specific. So we don't write, let me be absolutely clear. The issue of the security rights of prospectus, which generally speaking is done by securities lawyers who are professionals at just doing this. So it's really quite specific. And they are very big, meaty documents describing to you all the risks you're taking on board. And we have all sorts of disclosure all over the site associated with that as for the purchase of the security. It's a very regulated area, and it's the way you protect yourself, actually, as a broker and also an issuer. As a complete aside to that, how useful is it? I don't think it's that useful to people. I think what people want is actually one page or half a page of bullet points about what they're getting into, because then that would be of utility to them. Clearly, if they're investing a lot of money, then they need to read the full. But actually, is it really useful to someone making a $20 investment to have, you know, a 35-page prospectus written by, you know, the best Wall Street lawyers? Perhaps not.
Pretty much, just a YouTube video would be good.
So. It's an interesting question. So the answer to the question is, that's what we do. Those are the rules. We follow them. Go to microplace.com. And you have trouble sleeping or whatever, there's lots of great stuff you can read there. But is it actually of utility to an investor?
In our platform, so we put our borrowers through all the same steps that a bank would put them through, pulling credit, checking their ID, making sure there's no, you know, fraud. So trying to do all those things. And then on the investor side, there's kind of two sets of information. I absolutely agree the comment just made. So the way it should be looked at is, you know, you're a lender, you're like a bank, so you should be using banking best practices, static pool reporting, making sure that you're using defaults that you're likely to see over the life of the loan. I mean, at the end of the day, that's what's going to drive ROIs. What the SEC actually makes you do, though, again, they bring it into a securities world. So most of the disclosures that we have to file every single day, so we have to do an Edgar filing every single day on every single loan. Most of that's about our company. So they look at it as if we're the issuer. So there's just gobs of information about us, a private company, which frankly, you know, it's kind of a miss as far as what's the key risk. The key risk is on the borrower, is on the loan not being repaid. And the problem with that, again, is that it takes you into this whole realm that doesn't make much sense in a banking world. So for example, all the stuff that we have to go through, that is such an obstacle to so many new companies. Still, at the end of the day, there are no rules on what you report as far as returns. So there's two companies in the industry. They do it completely differently. There's nothing to say that you can't do compounding of interest versus simple. Of course, this should be simple. This is what these are, installment loans. There's no rules that say you have to use banking best practices on static pool reporting, so you have appropriately aged. You don't do the speedboating nonsense. No rules on that whatsoever. So not only is it a big obstacle, but exactly the point. It's not relevant, and needs to be looked at from a fresh eyes of what's the merit, what do people actually care about, and how do you get rid of these really expensive barriers that don't really do any good?
So, Danae, on Indiegogo, I mean, are there any kind of follow-up things that you do after someone's funded to make sure that someone got their DVD or CD back or something like that?
Yeah. I mean, again, we're built on transparency. And so kind of to answer kind of the specific question about is there any information that we tell people to provide, we give guidelines, but again, it's more of like a marketplace experience on the site. So if you give no information about your business, then it's up to the market to decide if people, you know, if they're going to fund you or not. And we put out a lot of insights around what kind of data, what kind of information is helpful to provide to help get people excited. And we do have mechanisms where we prompt people, make sure you're sending updates because that helps keep your funders engaged during your campaign and post your campaign and helps you launch a new campaign, maybe if you want to raise another round of money for the next phase of your project or a company. But it's all, again, it's marketplace driven, it's reputation driven. When you put yourself online and you say, I want to start a business, you're putting your entire reputation online. So in a way, that's an incredible dynamic and incredible mechanics to helping you follow through with what you say you're going to do, because you could completely destroy your reputation as an entrepreneur if you don't follow through.
Awesome. So Jessica, I remember a while ago, ProFounder had like a public and a private option.
Yeah.
And it seems like the public option doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, get comfortable. Ready? No. So we launched in December with two options. Our assumptions in the beginning, and maybe I should tell you right now because I just feel like I should at least say what we do. So ProFounder's platform, where any entrepreneur can come and they can do four things. They plan for their sort of ask to investors. They map out sort of who they think's out there that might be interested in contributing. Plan for different amounts that they might contribute, that sort of thing. Then part two is they actually upload information and fill out this profile online. Part three is they make the ask and they can get pledges online. Pretty simple. And then part four, once they do get the funding that they need and it's transferred, we do all online signing of term sheets, all legal documentation. We help with that. We help navigate state laws. And I can, again, go into Reg D Rule 504 if people want to go there, if we find that interesting. I feel like if any crowd would, it's this crowd. And then the last part too is, with that part four, we help with payouts to investors and communication with investors. So for example, if there's our first entrepreneur, they're amazing, couldn't have asked for a better one, but I think it'll help illustrate, and it'll also help illustrate the answer to this question, which was sort of
sure.
The public,
as long as
private.
It's quick, yeah.
Yeah, so, okay, well, I'll tell you about them in a minute, actually. What we thought initially was, look, Reg D Rule 504, is the exemption that we wanted to use to try this out at first, right? Version one, because it allows you to optimize for the maximum number of unaccredited, unsophisticated investors. Now, I'm doing this with my hands. I'm glad that was caught on camera, too, because they're not my words. It actually kind of bothers me to say unsophisticated, but it's a legal term. We have to deal with it, right? So we wanted to allow entrepreneurs to invite as many of those everyday people, those unsophisticated, unaccredited investors as possible. It turns out Reg D Rule 504 at the federal level says that you can have, if you're raising under $1 million in a 12-month period, you can have an unlimited number of unaccredited, unsophisticated investors as long as they're friends and family. Now, state laws, blue sky laws, trump federal law with Reg D Rule 504, so you also have to map out all the state laws as well and see how they sort of match up. So what we did was we created software that does this. We've mapped out every state law and each limitations. And there are, you know, dozens and dozens of characteristics that apply, but there are a few key ones that we mapped into the software. So for example, if you are the entrepreneur, you want to raise $100,000 for, or $48,000, whatever, to start a new corner cafe, you invite your friends and family, you upload financial data, self-reported financial data. So we don't go and pull tax returns. We actually thought of doing this, but it turns out that, again, it was too much trouble, and necessarily, as you're inviting people with whom you have a, again, legal terms here, substantial pre-existing relationship, there is reputation built in, right? So you're not, it's not general solicitation. You're not asking someone random who might just stumble upon to your listing to invest in you. So basically, where am I on all this? So basically, we allow, so if you're that entrepreneur, you post your opportunity and start to invite people to come invest. Let's say your first friend lives in Colorado. Well, God bless Colorado, because they allow for up to 499 unaccredited, unsophisticated investors, which is great. So you'd see, among other things, that one of the consequences of allowing that first, you know, person that's going to pledge money to you to invest is that, okay, your limit goes from 499 to 498. So you have 498 spots left. Let's say then you have a friend from California that comes and wants to invest. Well, you'd see that in California you have 35 spots. And so then you'd see if you take this investment from California too, that goes down to 35, you know, 34 minus the guy from Colorado or the woman from Colorado, down to 33. So we help you navigate. We have this, imagine a spreadsheet where you can kind of check and uncheck names, sort and search so you can say optimize for dollar amount, optimize for people involved, things like that. So we create tools for you to really plan this, even though the laws are, you know, maddening and in this big kind of a web, which we're trying to make it as simple as possible. To answer the question about public-private, one of our key assumptions going in was, as we learned about all these state limits, we're like, oh my gosh, this is awful. Why can't you have, you know, 100,000 people invest in your business? This isn't fair. What will somebody do if they want to raise $100,000 and they only have 35 spots in California? And so we thought necessarily we'd have to figure out sort of an overflow option. And so using the same sort of a la Kiva, right, with a 0% loan, which allowed us to kind of spread far and wide very quickly because it wasn't regulated in the same way, we thought, wouldn't it be great to do an investment that's not a real investment, not regulated? So I still think it's a lovely idea, but we said, look, you can either invest for a cash return or you can invest to have your cash return go to a nonprofit so that only up to 100% of your investment would be received back. Now, basically, we launched with these two, and I think one of the greatest lessons of crowdfunding is this. I'd love to hear, because I actually don't know what statistics are for your site, but talk to folks at Kickstarter and elsewhere. But it turns out, even though we did give people these two options, one that was technically, you know, private only, right? Friends, family, community members that you'd invite in. I know you can invite in 1,000 people if you'd like, but invite only versus the public opportunities. As we saw how these were working, the private opportunities succeeded a lot more, and the public opportunities that did succeed looked a heck of a lot like private opportunities. So the people that were contributing anyway for their financial return to go to the nonprofit, et cetera, were already known quantities and were pretty much invited in by the people directly anyway. So that's the short, I mean short, that's my answer for that. Is that?
No, that's perfect, that? Yeah. So I want to take one more question from the audience, actually. Maybe this guy who's waving his hand because he's more aggressive.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Okay. You're amazing. It's a king.
Thanks, Jessica, for that explanation.
Yes.
Kevin, I'd like to ask everyone to kind of just talk a little bit about the securities issue and just clarify. I know that MicroPlace is somewhat offering securities, but is that mostly international and Prosper, you're not really offering securities? And the issue of securities and also business share, like you were saying something earlier about businesses cannot get peer-to-peer loans. I'd like to kind of just go down that rabbit hole a little deeper and learn more about the securities Reg D and those kind of issues, if you don't mind.
Specifically, MicroPlace is registered with the SEC. We're a member of FINRA. We have to follow all the rules and regs that any broker-dealer has to follow. So if you're familiar with E-Trade or Schwab or any of those platforms, we fall under the same stuff. And what we offer are registered U.S. securities for today, anyway, for U.S. nonprofits. And the prospectus is registered in individual states, and you invest just like you would invest in any security. The capital is then deployed primarily around the rest of the world to support microfinance institutions. But to answer your question, basically we have to follow all the same rules and regs that anyone registering a security in the United States has to follow.
What's the liquidity of these securities?
I'm glad you asked, because I'm not allowed to promote, but I can answer a question. Classic example. This is a good example of answer regulation. So I'm not allowed to say to you, you have to read the prospectus, you have to understand the risk before you make these investments, okay? So I'm not allowed to say to you that for the last year or so we've offered the best retail investment in the United States. I'm not allowed to say that. It's absolutely clear, I'm not allowed to say that.
This isn't being recorded either.
So But I guess the point of how bleeding edge, how bloody difficult it is to do this stuff. You know, for example, when all the banks were crashing, when money market funds paid nothing and were blowing up, when your bank account paid nothing, when you didn't actually want to invest in, well, not you personally, but many people did not want to give their capital and money to Wall Street and bankers who were walking away with big bonuses and running away with all the money. People did want to, I could have, but I'm not allowed to, could have promoted a fully liquid investment that paid 175 basis points and was backed up primarily equity funded by Dutch church groups and had been around for 35 years and never defaulted. And that capital went to invest in the poorest people in the world to help them start businesses and really change the world. Now, I wasn't allowed to tell you that.
And just to correct, so we are registered as a security as well. So the SEC makes no distinction between loans or equity. So even a $25 loan that goes through our platform, the SEC would look at that like no different than a $100 million corporate bond issuance. We're also have to register with all the states. Unlike Wall Street, these new models are not exempt from blue sky state by state. So we have 50 additional regulators. Any Wall Street company wrote a law that they're exempt from all those rules. So still to this day, we're only live in 28 states on the lender side, 22 states, including Texas, Massachusetts, New Jersey, very, very tough. They don't even care what the SEC says. They're going to have their own process. So that's pretty hard. To the small business question, so if the entity is the small business, you cannot use these crowdfunding sources and make a profit, because the SEC, again, would look at that small business, even if they're only raising $5,000, and our average loan is about $6,500, they would see that small business is issuing like a $100 million corporate bond,
They do on ProFounder.
For equity, if it's the friends and family.
Well, equity, yeah, equity or rev share.
Yeah.
Just like you said, the loan and the equity are distinguished, rev share, any other structure.
So since we're going out to the general public, so we're not trying to limit the friends and family, that's the trigger. And therefore, that small business would need a $100,000 registration. So, but it can be a person borrowing money personally to use to their small business. That's what we allow. And we're about 10% of our marketplaces.
Cool. Let's squeeze in one more question. I think the gentleman here who's kind of pondering off, did you want to ask a question too?
Can you
slide the mic to him?
If you got a, if you gave people like a return in, let's say a virtual currency, would that help? That could actually, so like in, let me just give you an example. So in Kickstarter, people who have a project on Kickstarter will give, you know, a gift certificate or something to a restaurant, like $5. What if you took that and you monetized that or you turned it into a virtual currency? Would that be exempt from FCC laws, or is that?
My understanding, I'd love to hear from the rest of the panel, is it's essentially a securities versus e-commerce split. So when you're in e-commerce, you get governed by e-commerce rules. When you go to securities world, it's completely different. So I'll give you an example. Say you're in Mexico, and you borrow $100 from a microfinance institution, and I'm your buddy, and I want to remit $100 to you because, you know, remittances, you're familiar with that, I want to send you money, right? If I send you $100 through Western Union or through a banking organization, well, that all of a sudden becomes regulated incredibly. If, however, slightly differently, you borrow $100 from the microfinance institution, they put that opportunity on their website, and I do bill pay to pay down your loan. Are you with me? No? Too radical. I'm trying to give you an example of the difference between e-commerce and finance. If I send you $100, it's finance. If I pay your bill for somebody else, you owe someone $100, I pay your bill, it's e-commerce. It's the same thing. But to your point, if it in the realm of e-commerce, it's not securities and regulation. As soon as it's buying securities and paying people a return on their investment, it is. So I don't know the answer to your question, but yes, possibly.
Yeah, it won't work. I mean, it's against the law. The only advantage you have on the virtual currency thing is you might get a two-year window because the regulators won't figure out what the hell you're doing for about 2 years, and then maybe the law will change by the time you get to the other side. So that actually could work.
Yeah, we just think about finite value. Like on Indiegogo, you can offer whatever you want as perks in exchange for contributions. The only thing you can't offer is anything that is not finite in value. So to offer any kind of profit, upside or downside, equity stake, anything.
I guess it's just about time to wrap up, but I want to ask one question myself, actually, which is that when you think about, like, there's 200 crowdfunding platforms on Earth, something like that, all kinds of different varieties and stuff, you know, do you see a time when we'll ever be able to do, like, will there be a Google of the space where I can just go to one site and search and find, you know, projects that want to get funded across all these platforms?
I have a gut answer on that. I don't think so, and I don't think that'd be a good idea. I think the types of rewards offered on each one of our platforms, the types of opportunities, for better and for worse, there are nuances and there are a lot of differences, I think, great differences. So, and the communities that are drawn to each are really different. So I think scope is actually probably one of the most important things in this space. If you're going to start something, of course it sounds great to have this utopian come one, come all, it's Uber marketplace, everyone can fund everything, you know. I don't think it works. I think people want focus and they want platforms that know and are sort of specialized in the particular opportunity that they're offering.
So no Google.
I just wouldn't want that. I mean, it's not like it's hard to buy things. You can search for the crowdfunding.
I guess I came at it from the sort of perspective of what if a venture capitalist was looking across all these different platforms to find some good investments.
I love that all these platforms are going to help continue to democratize the space, but I don't think the venture capitalists would actually do that. I don't think that's behavior that would be likely to happen with venture capitalists.
Anyone?
They just go browse the marketplace. They want their deals and their networks and clubs. No offense.
Anyone else have some thoughts from the panel?
I don't think the government would allow it. Speaking of what government allows or not allows, I mean, we love the fact that there's multiple search engines. We love the fact that there's multiple online sites to buy shoes. Like, it's called competition. It's called the heart of our economy.
Well, we could certainly search across maybe Kickstarter versus Indiegogo, right? Search for a project.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Oh, like at the same time?
Yeah. Oh. It's like a meta search.
Oh, like a kayak for crowdfunding?
Exactly, yeah.
Maybe that's the next...
There's a good startup idea out there.
Startup idea.
I think it will be the same thing as today. I mean, you can search and you can find information about fixed income bonds or about stock, but you can't trade them through Google. It would be the same kind of thing.
I guess we got to wrap up there. I'm getting the end signal here. So let's hear from these people who are taking a lot of bullets for the space.
Thank you so much to all the panelists. That was fabulous. Really appreciate it.